Hi, I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. On this election day, we'll start with a check on how voting is proceeding so far, where long lines this morning suggest a healthy turnout. Then we'll turn our attention to public health and to some everyday things that have made a difference in wellness and the quality of our lives. The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health has identified 100 objects that have had a major impact on public health over the past century. Things like spittoons and toilets and window screens. From mundane appliances to medical innovations, many common things have had an uncommon impact on our well-being. We'll talk about them with Dr. Joshua Sharfstein of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He'll be my guest for the hour, and as always, you're invited to join our conversation. Midday is coming right up after the news. And thank you, Nathan. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I am indeed Tom Hall, and very glad you are with us. You know, if you weren't among the nearly 900,000 folks who cast their ballots during early voting last week, you've got about 8 hours left to get to the polls before they close at 8 o'clock tonight. You'll recall that in the April primary election, there were several polling places that encountered problems, particularly in the early hours of voting. Some of those polls opened late. That was the case again at more than one polling place in Baltimore City this morning. On the line is Metro reporter for WIPR, Kenneth Burns. Kenny, how you doing today?
I'm well, Tom. How about yourself?
Doing fine. You have been out and about checking out various polling places. What's the turnout look like, and what's the situation in terms of problems that some voters encountered the last time we tried this?
Well, the turnout has been steady, and the poll workers have been busy at the few polling locations that I've visited, particularly in Northwest and West Baltimore. Let's start with Northwest Baltimore. I stopped first at the Forest Park Senior Center. That was one of the four centers that had to stay open late because the centers themselves opened late, but that was not the issue at Forest Park. They opened on time. There were about 40 or 50 or so people in line, and it took about 20 minutes. Those wait times probably have increased since then, but things got off without a hitch at Forest Park. Not necessarily the case at Roland Park Elementary School. I've heard from one voter and the election judge that said that that location opened late. The one voter that I spoke with about a half hour ago said that location officially opened at about 7:40. And there seemed to be a confusion in regards to making sure everyone had both pages of the ballot. And then I also learned that there were some issues at Synagogue in Reservoir Hill.
Yeah, I was at that polling place myself. That's the place that I vote this morning. So when I was online at 10 minutes of 7 to vote, I will note that people were not allowed into the building until 7:14, so it was about 15 minutes late. And when we were allowed into the building, voting did not start taking place, actually, until 8 o'clock. The first ballot in the precinct that that I vote in did not take place until 8 o'clock, so they were about an hour late. I spoke to a poll worker there, and I also spoke to Armstead Jones, the head of the Baltimore City Board of Elections, who came to figure out what was going on there. It's difficult to ascertain with complete certitude what exactly happened, although we all witnessed a woman who appeared to be in charge get quite upset and emotional. She was screaming at a few people. We're not sure whether she was screaming to people that she was talking to behind a screen or whether she was on the phone screaming at somebody, but she appeared to be crying, and she left. We found out that she was the chief election judge of that precinct. Armstead Jones told me that a police officer had asked her to leave. Now, I haven't been able to verify that, but she did leave, and she had documents with her, and it was unclear as to whether or not the documents she was taking with her were going to affect the capacity for people to vote. I did speak to one voter there, a young woman named Morgan Jones, and this just breaks your heart, because when things like this happen, there are real casualties. Morgan Jones is a college student. She goes to CCBC in Baltimore County, and she had an exam this morning, and she was very concerned that her professor was going to flunk her in this exam if she showed up late. This is what she had to say about it.
I don't understand if I'm supposed to be voting and they want my demographic of a college student to vote, why am I not allowed to be out of school? I mean, elementary school students are out, but they're not the ones voting. I want to vote. I want to exercise my right. I want to, you know, do this favor for my country, but they make it hard for me. You know, help me be a better citizen. Help me help myself. Help me help my country. But they're doing everything in their power not to let me do that, you know, and it's really, I don't get it. Colleges should be out, or at least, like, you know, you should be like half a day or something like that, so that I can come in strolling late because I was voting, because I was helping my country, because I was doing my part as a citizen. But I'm not, and it's frustrating. So now I'm either going to be late for my exam, or I'm not going to be able to vote because I still have schoolwork to do too.
And just a few minutes later, Ms. Jones did in fact have to leave the polling place without casting a vote. She had been there before 7 o'clock waiting to vote, among the first people allowed in, and she was not able to vote before she had to leave to go to school. There were several other people that I witnessed in Reservoir Hill having to leave before they could cast a ballot. Kenny, did you see any of that? Did you see folks just get frustrated? They had to get to work, they had to get to school, and they were forced to leave the polling place before they cast ballots?
I have not seen that personally, but the one voter that I spoke with who voted at Roland Park Elementary School earlier today, he did mention that there were a couple of people that had to leave because they either had to report to school or report to work at a certain time. Now, there was one thing that we should mention. There was reports of efforts by people on behalf of the campaign of Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump to recruit poll watchers to watch some polls in Baltimore City. And I checked in with several of those polls, and so far there have been no poll watchers looking out on behalf of the Trump campaign.
All right. Well, that's good to know. And Kenny, we will, of course, be checking in with you later this evening when our live election coverage begins at 8 o'clock here on WIPR. Well, thank you so much. We'll let you get back to checking out what's going on, and we'll check in with you a little bit later this evening. Thanks, Kenny Burns.
Thank you, Tom.
Metro reporter Kenneth Burns from our WIPR news team. About 42 million people across the country voted early in 37 states that allow it. That's way more than it was in previous elections. We don't know yet what the turnout will be on this election day, but we do know that the percentage of eligible voters in the United States who voted in 2012 was only 53%. So today on Midday, we're going to defer more talk about the election and the health of our democracy in favor of talking about our health in general and the devices and innovations that we may not give much thought to that have helped us stay healthy over the years. Just a century ago, the average life expectancy in the United States was 52 years old. Today, it's almost 79 years old. Contagious diseases like the flu used to be death sentences, but they are now generally kept under control with vaccines and better hygiene and improved public sanitation. Dr. Joshua Sharfstein joins me in Studio A. He's the Associate Dean of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Previously, he served as the Secretary of the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, the Principal Deputy Commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and as Baltimore City's Health Commissioner. Josh, it's good to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks, Tom.
So you guys at Hopkins School of Public Health, the Bloomberg School of Public Health, came up with a list, 100 lists of objects. I guess you all are celebrating your 100th anniversary. Is that right?
That's right. Our school is the first school of public health in the world and started in 1916. It's the 100th anniversary. So as part of the celebration for that, we identified these 100 objects really as a conversation starter about public health.
Interesting. So you all have been around for 4 years longer than women have had the right to vote in the United States. So that's good to know here on this election day. So there were so many things that humankind had to contend with 100 years ago that we no longer have to contend with. And some of the reasons that that's the case are for some very simple objects and things that we really do take for granted, but they really have had a major impact on keeping people healthy, haven't they?
Yeah, and I think you made the point. A lot of it may be true that the average life expectancy was in the early 50s, but a lot of people died before that. I mean, people really didn't expect to get to their 60s or 70s 100 years ago, and people do expect that now, obviously, or even longer, 80s or 90s. And public health has had a great deal to do with that. It could be argued that it may have had more to do with that even than all the medical care that's out there.
Of course, you've got things like childbirth and infant mortality, too. I mean, those rates have gone up, although it's still staggering and sad to understand that here in Baltimore, for example, a kid born tomorrow in Roland Park will have, by some estimates, a 20-year longer life expectancy than a kid born tomorrow in Harlem Park. So we've still got a lot of work to do. But let's talk about some of these products. You've got various categories. You've got various things that these objects have helped. One of the ones that struck me, well, many of them struck me, and we'll try to get to as many of them as we can. By the way, if you all would like to join our conversation, you're welcome to call us at 410-662-8780. Send us an email, midday@wipr.org, or a tweet. Our handle is @MiddayTomHall. But the horseshoe crab. Now, it looks like there was a scientist at the Bloomberg School of Public Health who understood back in the 1950s that the blood of horseshoe crabs could be very useful for scientific purposes.
I think you're referring to Professor Bang. So Professor Bang noticed...
Frederick Bang, yes, that's right.
Noticed that the blood... was able to detect a tiny amount of bacterial endotoxin, which can cause a cardiovascular collapse if it's enough. And just the teeniest amount. They said that the equivalent of a grain in a swimming pool. And what happens is the blood congeals, and you can see that there's a positive. And so it became used to test batches of vaccines or IV solutions, because it would spot if it had been contaminated very, very quickly and very reliably, and it's still used today.
Yeah. There's another one here, and as I say, some of these items and objects that you list, these 100 objects, are unbelievably commonplace. One of them is the furniture anchor.
So,
when we talk about kids, I mean, it's an amazing number of children who are injured and even killed each year because furniture falls on top of them. That's amazing.
Well, one of the reasons we put this list together is because when public health is successful, you don't really think about it. I mean, the window screens that keep out the mosquitoes, or the speed limit signs that everybody just sort of takes for granted, even sidewalks, which kept people off the roads but allow them to walk. These are things that we don't think of as public health, but they all make us healthier. Furniture anchors, it's sort of something you do now. But there was a time before furniture anchors, and it was just sort of, it was just horrible tragedies. People use the word accident. This is an accident, meaning it's just sort of like a fact of nature or fate. But part of what the science of injury prevention is that it's not an act of fate. You can prevent it. And this is why we got seatbelts. It's why when my son is getting his driver's license, it's like in 12 different stages. First, he gets to drive with me, then only by himself. He can't be with friends. One little step at a time. Not when I, was a driver. I was just thought, it's just the case that teenage boys are going to get into a lot of accidents. So, all these things you kind of would say, it's just an accident, like furniture falling over, can be prevented. And when you do that, it just becomes part of the way we live, except more people live.
For a long time, one child every 2 weeks dies because a piece of furniture falls on him or her. I mean, that's amazing. That's a lot of little children. And it's just a matter of hooking it up to the wall,
Yeah, well, people get very, very upset sometimes, even today, about requirements that are put on consumer products. Because they say, I've never seen a problem. I don't know anybody like that. But even if it's one every 2 weeks, that's an enormous number of kids.
Sure.
Over time. And then when you do it, you forget about it. So, we were involved in Maryland, for example, in banning the sale of bumper pads that go inside cribs. And people are like, oh, my God, because kids can suffocate or strangle. And, for a minute there, people really wonder whether that would change their lives forever. And then it just has gone on. It's been banned. We've had a dramatic decline in those deaths. Baltimore City's infant mortality rate is a historic low as a result. And you kind of move on. What's interesting about these 100 objects is you can see all the things that might have been controversial at the time, now we just sort of have moved on, and we have a lot more people alive because of it.
Of course, it's an election day, and on election day, the basic notion of the role of government is on the ballot, and obviously the people on the left side of the political spectrum have a different notion, a different concept of what government should be. People on the right often find themselves diametrically opposed to that view from the left. in your experience in public health for all these years, whether at the city level, the federal level, the state level, it does take public policy. In other words, the market has not always been the best place to impose regulations and criteria for safety of products. It takes laws in the public sphere to push companies who are making things like the bumpers in the cribs to change what they're doing.
Well, those
in the
laws,
cause of
right,
public health.
Those laws protect all of us, and you wouldn't want to go back to a time where people could sell medicines and not know whether they worked or whether they were safe. But there's another interesting lesson from that history, which is the industry tends to do better when there's smart regulation. So take the drug regulation. Go back to 1961 when thalidomide was in Europe and causing enormous numbers of horrible birth defects. And a drug reviewer named Francis Kelsey at the Food and Drug Administration stopped that drug from being approved in the United States. Well, that led Congress to pass a law. The law required that there be evidence for drugs that they work before they get onto the market. And the consequence of that law is that suddenly when drugs were on the market, they had evidence for them. And when they had evidence for them, people prescribed them more. And so the pharmaceutical industry did incredibly well with that level of regulation because they weren't competing against people who had whipped something up in their backyard, you know, speaking a little bit
metaphorically,
off the cuff here. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And just claiming whatever. In order to make a claim that something really treated disease, you had to go through this review process. So that review process not only protected consumers, it led to a golden age of pharmaceuticals and the modern pharmaceutical industry. So I think in public health policy, we both want to have, you know, to be able to support a robust economy, but also save lives at the same time.
Yeah, and we should say that the things on this list are not all good. Some of these things are things that have affected public health negatively. So you've got, examples of things that have, you know, moved the ball forward and definitely some that have moved the ball backwards.
Joe Camel, I don't know if you remember Joe Camel.
I do.
Maybe the kids don't, but there was a famous study that more kids, I think, recognize Joe Camel than Mickey Mouse. And that was a study. Joe Camel was a advertising icon
for Camel cigarettes,
and which I believe is R.J. Reynolds. And, you know, it was, oh, this is really just for our adult smokers. But in fact, kids really saw it. It was a cartoon. And it was really the end of Joe Camel was really the end of an era where companies were really allowed to deny marketing to kids when they really were doing that.
Dr. Joshua Sharfstein is the former Baltimore City Health Commissioner. Now he's the Associate Dean of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We're talking about the school's online list of 100 objects that have had a significant impact on public health, for good or for ill, over the past century. We're going to take a short break right now. What objects or inventions do you think have had a major impact on public health? The list is posted at WIPR.org/midday. You can check out the list and give us a call, 410-662-8780. Our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. We'll be back in a flash. Stick around.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. A reminder that just as Nathan was saying, coming up tonight at 8 o'clock, NPR and WYPR will have complete election coverage. I'll be joined here in Studio A by Fraser Smith, WYPR's senior news analyst, and our team of WYPR reporters will fan out around the city and the state to bring you the latest news on all of the important local elections in concert with the national returns from our colleagues at NPR. And then tomorrow on Midday, analysis of the elections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland, Michael Fletcher of ESPN's The Undefeated, and Barry Raskovar from MarylandReporter.com. So right now, while voting continues for the next 7.5 hours or so, you are in an election-free zone. We're taking a look at the list of the 100 objects that shaped public health, published by the Bloomberg School of Public Health, with their Associate Dean, Dr. Joshua Sharfstein. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wypr.org, or you can drop us a tweet at midday Tom Hall. So, Josh, let's talk about a few more of these objects. One of them is the bifurcated needle. So that's a needle with not one but two points. Why is that such an important innovation?
That needle played a critical role in ridding the world of smallpox. Smallpox is just absolutely horrible, lethal disease, killed millions and millions of children around the world. And there was a vaccine, but the problem was it was really hard to get the vaccine to all these remote places where smallpox was. And when you got it there, people would draw up too much in the syringe, and it was really tricky to figure out, because you had to get it just under the skin in a certain way. It was called a special kind of way to provide the vaccine. And someone figured out, actually the person who figured out, whose name I don't remember, he actually passed away, that if you had a needle with two points at the end, it would hold one little perfect size drop of vaccine in suspension just by the adhesion of the liquid to the sides of the needle. And you could just dip it in and you'd get the perfect dose, and then you could twirl it right onto the skin, and using that bifurcated needle, they eliminated smallpox. The person who led that campaign, D.A. Henderson, who's the dean of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, recently died. And just last week, we had a memorial service for him. And people came from around the world who had worked on that campaign and told all these stories. The guy sitting next to me at dinner had a little bifurcated needle and like a pin on his, and he said he was part of the Order of the Bifurcated Needle. That's what they called themselves. Those were the people who are working in the most remote corners of the world to track down the last cases of smallpox, because it was only in humans. When the last case went away, it was gone, and it's the only disease to be eradicated.
Does it give you hope that, for example, people like Bill and Melinda Gates are concentrating on malaria? That's a big cause célèbre of the Gates Foundation. Does it give you hope that malaria might one day be completely eradicated?
Diseases
like
that? The next one that everyone's going for is polio, which would be tremendous to be able to eradicate polio. Malaria, there's an enormous amount of work on. There's a malaria institute at our school that is, you know, responsible for some incredible breakthroughs in understanding how malaria works. And one of our objects actually relates to the early treatment of malaria, which is gin and tonic. People may not realize that drink was developed in part to mask the taste of the quinine that was part of the tonic.
That's on the list, right?
Yeah. And
the quinine was a protector against malaria.
Exactly. So, you know.
So you had to, the quinine tasted so terrible that you had to mix it with gin to make it.
Exactly. So my guess palatable. Is very few people who are drinking gin and tonics realize its connection to public health.
That's right. You're not thinking malaria when you're drinking a gin and tonic, generally speaking, at least not here in Maryland. Got a couple folks calling with some ideas about some objects that they think are also important to public health. Ben in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Josh Sharstein.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I think liquor store bags, the black bags, are a big pollution to the city. I generally call them liquor pigeons. As I'm driving around, I'm a home health nurse in West Baltimore, and I see them flying around all over the city. And it says, for me at least, it says a lot about the health of the city, how many people are drinking, and how many, and also the pollution. But I was actually, while I was waiting, I was wondering if there's, if your host has any insight as to the health of either a city based on, what we see on the streets.
In terms of the predominance of liquor stores in particular, perhaps, Josh. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a really interesting suggestion, because what you're saying is the bags really capture two things. They capture trash and they capture alcohol. And we know
so
that
bad for the environment, right, and bad for our innards.
And, in Baltimore, there's been a lot of thought about the concentration of liquor stores in parts of the city and that association with a whole variety of challenges. And the Planning Commission, I think, through its zoning practices, has tried to reduce the number of corner liquor stores in certain areas. And it's, I think, a really important part of thinking about what a healthy environment is. You know, so much of our health is not what happens after we've already had the heart attack. It's what goes into our lives. And You know, I think an environment where there are liquor stores in every corner is not as healthy as an environment where there are parks in every corner.
And just the notion, and Ben, that's a great idea. Thanks for your call. Just the notion of garbage bags in general. When I was a little kid, we didn't use garbage bags. I mean, I grew up in the 50s and 60s. Trash cans, you know, you just put the trash. I mean, direct from your, you know, your trash can in the kitchen, it went out and you dumped it into a can and then the people came by and picked it up. We've now put all this stuff in plastic bags, which keeps the trash cans cleaner, and I suppose it's a good thing in a lot of ways. But, of course, those plastic bags create a huge environmental impact on their own.
In some cities, you have to pay 5 cents to get a plastic bag because they want people to use recycled bags. Some of the objects we do have on here are the water bottles and the K-cups for coffee. People, I mean, I think the more general point is things that we may have that are for convenience, like bags or single-serving coffee, actually could pose significant environmental risks, and they really do add up. It's a tremendous amount of waste.
Yeah, the K cups are those things where you make individual cups of coffee by a company called Keurig Green Mountain. And in 2014, somebody figured out that enough K cups were sold that if you place them end to end, they would circle the globe 10 and a half times. Individual K cups, 10 and a half times would circle the globe because so many people are using them.
I've had mornings where I thought I needed that much coffee.
Yeah, right. But I mean, that's a lot. So then the company has assured everybody that by 2020, so it's still in 4 more years, they'll come up with something that's more recyclable and more environmentally friendly.
Well, I do think that the role of the environment in health is something that is a more modern connection that's being drawn. And you see that in the plastic bag laws. You see it in the pressure on companies like this. I think we increasingly realize we can't separate them, have one environmental policy and one health policy when there's so much connected.
It's all connected. You're listening to Midday. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Dr. Joshua Sharfstein from the Bloomberg School of Public Health is here. We're talking about the 100 objects that have most affected public health over the last 100 years as the Bloomberg School celebrates its 100th anniversary. Going back to the phones now, Gary from Canton. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Yes. For about 10 years, I sat next to a man who probably saved more lives in the 20th century than anyone else, a woman, well-known name, particularly Hopkins. His idea was to add chlorine gas, one of the deadliest poisons, the water, to kill bacteria in the water. Chlorine gas is very unstable. And the thing is, after it was added to the water, killed all the nasties, they would then aerate it and create little fountains, and the oxygen would dissipate the chlorine gas, therefore making safe, clean drinking water. And if you look at history, I think perhaps more people would be killed by foul or infected water than anything else.
And absolutely correct. It's on our list. The water treatment that Abel Woolman pioneered. Interested in why? Where were you sitting next to him?
At the Lyric Symphony, Lyric Theater.
Okay.
At the Baltimore Symphony. He was just a very friendly person. Oddly enough, my best friend was about 40 years older than I was. He's an amazing person. His older brother was a classmate and a very good friend of Abel Woolman. That almost every time before he left, Abel Woolman would pat him on the back and said, "Be sure to give my regards to young Henry."
That's a great story, and he was a legend in public health. He implemented this in Baltimore. It went all over the country. He saved so many lives by clean water, which is something we take for granted. I mean, if you think about the horrible, you know, episode and ongoing episode, what's happening in Flint, Michigan, it's just shocking to think that what you drink in coming out of your faucet could make you sick. But in fact, that was what it was like for everyone all the time until these kinds of technologies were introduced.
Unless you're a student at a Baltimore City public school, because you still can't drink the water in the fountains in the Baltimore City public school system in most of the schools.
Well, I was the one who turned off the fountains, so I know that story pretty well. Yeah, exactly, and I would do it again.
Yeah, well, Gary, thank you for your call. That's a great suggestion. One of the things that you have on the list, the folks here at WYPR are delighted to see, it's radio. How does radio help public health, you may ask? I mean, is it that people get mellow on Saturday nights when they hear a Prairie Home Companion? Well, in the event of disasters and other public health emergencies, there is a system in place in which WYPR participates to get the word out on this emergency network. And that started with radio. It didn't start with TV. It started with radio.
Yeah, and the other thing that radio is very good for is for public health messaging and campaigns. And that's not just a message that says, you know, here is your health commissioner telling you what to do. That those types of messages aren't that effective. But sometimes it's actual fictional shows that embed public health messaging or help people think through public health challenges. An example of that would be programs in Africa that helped people understand the risk of HIV.
Yeah, and there are even programs here in America that helped, and your researchers mentioned this on the list, help reduce the stigma of getting tested and treated for HIV because people heard discussions about it on programs like Midday and On the Record. And
so you like this one particularly?
I do. I'm a fan of this one. You know, okay. I'm a fan of a lot of them, but, you know, of course.
We got Gin and Tonic.
You got Gin and Tonic. Those are my two favorite, and that says something a little bit, you know, untoward about me, but that's a whole other story. That's a different show. One of the things on the list is the cook stove. Half of the world cooks in an open fire, an open charcoal or wood fire. And cook stoves, the World Health Organization estimates that about 4.5 million people a year die prematurely from the indoor pollution that is created by these cook stoves that are in people's homes that aren't aerated correctly.
There's an enormous health risk from particulate matter that people breathe in. It undermines their lung capacity over time. It's incredibly dangerous, particularly long-term exposures. Indoor air pollution through cook stoves, outdoor air pollution in some parts of the world is just fierce and is really lopping years off of life expectancy.
On 88.1, it's Midday with Tom Hall and Josh Sharfstein from the Bloomberg School of Public Health. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayTomHall. Going to go back to the phones now. Julian in Columbia, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sharfstein.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A very interesting program. I have a question. You referenced, Dr. Sharfstein referenced the process that is goes through at FDA to make sure that drugs are effective and not dangerous before they're released to the public, and how that's a good thing. I'm curious about his perception and comments on what we've done here in Maryland and other states where the voters have determined that marijuana is a drug that should be used in medicine. Or should be used for medicinal purposes.
Public health policy being decided by the voters, by referendum rather than by public health officials.
Well, I have a bit of a track record on this. When this question first came up, I was the secretary of Maryland's health department, and what I testified was that you could think of marijuana from a green light perspective, meaning it's good for what ails you. Let's just help as many people as possible get it because we think it'll work for A, B, C, and D diseases. You could have a red light perspective saying, absolutely not, it's a controlled substance. We're not going to, you know, permit this under any circumstances. But that personally, my view is a yellow light perspective, which is that you would want evidence for it. And I felt like it was most analogous to an investigational drug, something that might have benefits but might also have risks. And before it's widely used, it really needs to be studied. That remains my view. Wasn't all that popular. At one point, my brother called me and said, I don't know what you're doing, but you're ruining the family name on Twitter. So I think that there are definitely some people who, you know, they believe that it is a effective treatment, you know, and part of my training is that I'm open to that idea, but you really want to see the evidence and you want to understand where it works because it can cause a number of different side effects, particularly different kinds of psychiatric side effects.
To say nothing of the political ramifications where some states allow recreational use. Other states do not. There was when Colorado and Washington approved it for recreational use, there was a problem with the financial setup of these companies. They couldn't deposit the money they were making in federally insured banks because it was against the law on the federal level to be dealing right. dope. But in Colorado, it was legal. I mean, it was all very complicated.
It's complicated. I would just say that the issue of whether to make it legal, period, is sort of social policy. But it's I do think that if the question is whether it works, that's actually a factual question. That's not something you can resolve at the ballot box.
All right. Dr. Joshua Sharfstein is my guest today. We're going to take a look at some more of the items on the list of the 100 objects that shaped public health. We've got the list posted at our website, wypr.org/midday. You can join the conversation when we come back from a break, 410-662-8780. Our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall, our email address midday@wypr.org. Really glad you're with us today. Stick around.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today is Dr. Joshua Sharfstein. He's the Associate Dean of the Bloomberg School of Public Health here in Baltimore. We're talking about the list of the 100 objects that have shaped public health over the last 100 years. You are welcome to join our conversation. Our telephone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Josh, we have an email from a public health nurse. She's a nurse with the Frederick County Health Department, Margaret. And she says, as a nurse in the Frederick County schools, I'd like to highlight what I believe to be the most important public health innovation of all time, soap. Which is, in fact, Margaret, on the list. It's a simple product that we take for granted. Ain't that the truth? But not all in the world have access to this very simple disease preventative measure. Soap is on the list.
It is, and it's really interesting, and it's a great point. You know, if you go all the way back in history, when some people started saying, you know, if you wash your hands, it's less likely to cause disease, nobody believed them. They're famous stories of surgeons.
It was a surgeon at Hopkins who understood that a sanitary environment for surgery was a good idea.
Yeah, but that was controversial. You know, there's a famous case of a doctor who would feel people's tongues and predict that they would then get sick. Of course, he was passing the bacteria from person to person. But one of the interesting things about that, despite that history, even today, hand washing is an incredibly important topic for healthcare facilities. When I worked in the state, there was a big campaign to make sure that people in the hospital washed their hands, and that would reduce the rate of infections. And the infections that are in hospitals are often antibiotic resistant. So, you know, to get hand washing, and the key to reducing it turns out to be having monitors who go into the floors of the hospital and aren't known to be monitors, and they kind of look around and they track. And so people know there are going to be unknown monitors on their floor. Then you can really get a sense of whether people are washing their hands.
I remember visiting my orthopedic surgeon who was going to operate on my knee. And it was at his office. It wasn't in the hospital. And when I finished that visit, I was given a questionnaire, and I was asked to estimate the number of times I observed him and the residents that were with him washing their hands. This is for an office visit, a preoperative visit for my busted knee. And I thought that's interesting that, you know, and this is at Hopkins Hospital, they were really, you know, trying to calculate the number of times physicians were washing their hands, even when they weren't in the operating room.
Absolutely. And Peter Pronovost and the safety team at the Armstrong Institute at Hopkins, they're spreading the gospel of how to do effective hand washing around the world.
Where do you stand on the issue of whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing for people to use those portable hand sanitizers? You know, people have the stuff that dries on its own.
Sure.
And there are those who say that because we're using it so much, we're becoming antibiotic resistant, that we're getting rid of the microbes that could help us ultimately fight off some of these infections?
I think probably the benefits exceed the risks for the alcohol-based hand sanitizers. Now, that's not necessarily the case for all antiseptics. There's some chemicals that people were adding to soap that really didn't have any benefits, but they were being marketed as like, this is super antibacterial soap, and the FDA has finally moved ahead and taken those off the market.
Let's go to a couple more calls. Tom in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Joshua Sharfstein.
Good afternoon, folks. I was wondering if you could ask your guest, since brake shoes on vehicles and brake pads still use asbestos, and as they wear out, that dust is deposited on city streets. Does your guest have any comment on that?
That's an interesting question, Tom. Thank you for your call. Obviously, the car seats, are on the list. Cars in general are on the list because they, have helped us get around a lot easier. But when there are things like, well, for example, another one is the aerosol can. That's on the list, and it's set in a deleterious light rather than a helpful light because of the fluorocarbons that are contained within. So while aerosol cans is a great way of it was evidently initially invented during the Second World War to be a conveyor of mosquito spray, bug spray, there's a downside. But with something like asbestos, which, does exist on most of the cars that many of us are driving.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, the major risk to asbestos is for people who had occupational exposure because they were being exposed to huge amounts of asbestos. And that's where you get the mesothelioma and other cancers from that. I am not aware of data showing a risk from what comes out. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but I have not seen as an issue. I think one of the goals would be to try to phase out asbestos because whenever it is made or used, you have the potential for occupational exposure. But
they are revamping the way they convey everything from ready whip to, off in the aerosol cans.
Exactly. And a lot of times it has to do with the manufacturer where the real risk is, not so much at the end user. I'm not exactly sure about this one. Mm-hmm.
But that's a good question, Tom. Thank you so much. We're going to go to Tim in Hagerstown. Tim, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you. This is a great topic. I was wondering if the irradiation of beef, which was politically contentious for a while, is one of the things on list and how effective that has been at reducing infection by bacteria in food.
Yeah, excellent question, Tim. Thanks. So irradiation of food, genetically modified foods. I mean, these are hot topics in public health.
They're hot topics and I think probably generally misunderstood topics. The irradiation is quite effective at eliminating harmful bacteria, although people hear the word irradiation and they can be kind of stressed out about it. Similarly, genetically modified makes people pretty stressed out, although the evidence does not support that there have been significant or even, substantial harms from that. I think FDA, where I worked, really had a challenge because you have a known problem. The known problem might be bacterial contamination of food, and then you have a solution to it, but then people are concerned about a theoretical risk associated with the solution, and sometimes that can overwhelm your ability to talk about the known problem in the first place. So, I think one of the challenges of the future for public health is being able to talk about, you've got to be open to the fact that things can backfire, there can be adverse consequences, but we have an increasing expectation that we live in a risk-free society. And yet there are all these things that lurk. We had Ebola come back. We've had all kinds of challenges. And it's really important to keep in mind the benefits of different innovations and not just be looking at the risk side.
It's Midday. That's Dr. Joshua Sharfstein of the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our Twitter handle, at Midday Tom Hall. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. There are so many things on this list, Josh, that are really fascinating. And I do encourage you to go to our website, wypr.org/midday, and check out the list. One of the ones that fascinated me is the sippy cup. Anybody who's a parent of a young child will know that sippy cups are invaluable in terms of saving the linoleum in your kitchen floor.
The sanity of parents.
And the sanity in parents. But why is the sippy cup on the list as a public health helper?
Well, it is on the list for exactly what I was talking about before. It is one of those challenging, it reflects a challenge in understanding risk. And in this case, it was bisphenol A, which is a chemical that was in sippy cups that's been phased out. And in about 5 or 6 years ago, there was enormous amount of attention on whether this was an extremely harmful chemical. And it is in a lot of different food containers, in part to reduce the chance of bacterial contamination. And so FDA had to look strategically at each different use and decide whether it could be phased out given the balance of risk and benefit. But that was a very difficult message to explain to people, because if you think about it just as the risk, and if people are just saying, this is risky, this is risky, this is risky, it's hard to, you know, be able to see the pluses and minuses. And in the end, FDA did phase it out of sippy cups after the manufacturers stopped using it.
Let's try to sneak in a couple more calls before we have to call it quits for today. Hilda and Frederick, welcome to Midday with Dr. Josh Sharfstein.
Yes, I talked to you before about the Hoggard.
Hilda, we're kind of losing you. Hilda, are you there? Hilda?
Yes, I'm here.
Uh-huh. And so you have a question about something that might be on the list, and that has to do with lard. What's on your
yes.
mind?
Yes. When we were children, my mother made all of our soap out of Hoggard, and she used it to do the laundry.
And did you bathe with it and use it to wash your hands and
did.
Stuff like that?
We used it to wash dishes. We used it for everything.
Uh-huh. So this is animal fat, Josh Sharfstein. What do you think? Is that a good thing to use for, you know, a purpose other than eating?
I think that it probably did have some of the same properties as soap. I'm not an expert in that field, but do you remember that fondly? I'm curious.
The soap?
Yeah. I mean, did it make you smell good?
Well, toward the end, she got something that she used to put in, but I don't think it ever had a smell at all.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Well, thanks for the call, Hilda. One of the things about food that's on the list is American cheese. This is an alphabetical list, and American cheese is up near the top of it. Of course, when food started being processed, it was processed for a very good reason, and that was to make it last longer. But then the scale kind of tipped at some point, where we are now consuming as a society so much processed food that it's in fact having a negative effect on the body politic.
Well, I think that's right. The body politic and the body of a lot of Americans, the processed food and just the massive shifts that have happened in the food supply have partly fueled the obesity epidemic that we have in the United States. And the American cheese is sort of both American, but also cheese. And so the fact is our culture has supported the use of the consumption of a lot of different foods. And as that continues to accelerate, that may have adverse health consequences. And American cheese sort of is the symbol of that.
We got time for just one more thing, and this is shoes. Shoes are on the list of the 100 objects, and it's on the list because it's helped decrease and get rid of the contraction of hookworms, because there are so many people in the world, millions and millions, who don't have shoes.
Well, it's a great one to end with, because that campaign to eliminate hookworm in the American South, in part by using shoes, is one of the things that convinced John Rockefeller to fund the first school of public health in the country, which is the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Mm-hmm. It's hard to believe, but every day when you're walking around, that's one of the reasons that we even have a school of public health in Baltimore.
Because of shoes. Very good. Dr. Joshua Sharfstein is the Associate Dean of the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. We've got a link to the list of the 100 objects that shape public health on our website, wypr.org/midday. Josh, good to see you. Thank you so much. This has been fun.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for us today. A reminder that you have until 8 o'clock tonight to cast your vote if you have not already done so. And at 8 o'clock, I hope you'll join me and WYPR's senior news analyst, Fraser Smith, for complete election coverage with the WYPR news team and NPR. We'll have the latest returns in Baltimore City and throughout the state of Maryland, along with, of course, returns and analysis of the presidential race and the important races around the country that will determine the balance of power in the Senate and the Congress. It all starts tonight at 8 o'clock here on 88.1. WIPR. Tomorrow on Midday, we'll have analysis of all of the elections, and we'll have a look ahead to the to the, you know, the kind of political landscape that the president-elect will encounter. I'll be joined here in Studio A by three terrific analysts, Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland, Michael Fletcher of ESPN's The Undefeated, and political commentator Barry Raskovar from MarylandReporter.com. I want to thank also Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizza, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Thanks so much for being part of Midday Today. I'm Tom Hall. We'll see you when the polls close. Have a great day.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.